So this is July 9th, 2014. I'm Rick Hansen. And I want to talk about bowing. Bowing. Not violin or bow, that's bowing. Our son did a lot of that with his viola. Bowing. And so I want to talk about this in different kinds of ways. And I've been wanting to talk about bowing for some time now. And you may be glad when I'm done that I waited this long. I don't know. So let me explain kind of my way into this topic here. So I was a friend of mine some years ago who practices mainly in a Tibetan tradition, mentioned in passing with some relief that he had completed 100,000 prostrations. And I had two kinds of reactions to that. In the context of a full prostration, which I'll not try to do right now, basically you start standing, you end absolutely flat on the ground with your arms stretched out before you, and then you get up again. That's one. Now you have 99,999 to go, right? So my first reaction was, oh my God, are you okay? You know, like, whoa, that's a lot. How's your back, dude? And so next, I had a sense of awe and respect that was slightly tinged with envy, in a sense of not like, oh, I didn't want him to have that experience, but a sense of, wow, I could see how that could be profoundly valuable to do. You may also know of the recent example, and I forget some of the details, where a monk basically walked down Highway 1 on the coast of California and roughly every three paces did a full prostration. Got up again, walked three paces, did a full prostration. He didn't make many miles per hour, right? Traffic tended to slow around him. What's this bald guy in orange robes doing flat on the ground? Wait, he's moving, he's not dead. We don't need to call the 911, right? But there was something about it that really touched people as well. So why is it that people bow in so many traditions, not just conventionally bow, right, but very respectfully, even reverentially bow? What is that about? I bow here at the very beginning of our sitting. For me, that's a way of bowing to you all. So I bow to you at the very end. And I bow again at the end of the sit. So I bow at the beginning of the sit and at the end of the sit. In both ways to you, and especially at the end of the sit, a kind of bowing toward what we've all created together. Why do we do this? Why do people bow? In whatever form it is, you know, like this or like that, or full prostration or like this, or whatever is meaningful to a person. What's that about, right? How does it become such a meaningful part of people's practices? And so I want to explore a couple notions about this with you and ask you, as I talk about this, what do you bow to and why? What don't you bow to, and why not? So one way to think about bowing, and I think there are easily three different things we bow to, is we bow toward that which we have reverence for, or we feel is for us something sacred. It could be that we go out at night and we see that vast bowl of dark sky above our heads, pinpricks of light, and something in us bows to it. We may not move. We might joke about it with our friends, but deep in our heart, some kind of bowing is happening, some kind of gesture of respect and honor, and in some sense, surrender or submission to that which is miraculous, extraordinary, worthy of great reverence. Even that which is sacred. We might also bow to certain teachers or to certain traditions or to certain sites. I was raised a very casual Christian. We would go to church typically twice a year, Christmas and Easter. And I was discouraged to come to Sunday school. I started asking questions about the parting of the Red Seas and the papier-mâché models we made. That said, when I go in cathedrals, for example, just some of the most beautiful buildings around the world, or other kind of church settings, I'll find myself just naturally putting a hand over my heart on the way in the door. There's something I'm respecting. It's a natural movement. It feels in harmony with the setting. So you might ask yourself, what is worthy for you of this sort of bow? A bow of reverence, respect, a nod toward, a bow toward that which you find sacred, however you mean that, with or without reference to something transcendental. I was at Spirit Rock on a retreat there run by monastics in the Theravadin tradition, which is it's hard to say exactly what its relationship to the transcendental is or isn't. And the abbot there, an Englishman, very, very bright, very kind of skeptical in his disposition in some ways, just invited us around the third day of the treat to dedicate our practice that day to the sacred, whatever was sacred for ourselves. So think about that. Dedicating your practice that day and the day after that, if you want, to that which you find sacred. That's really quite an exploration, isn't it? What do we find sacred? What would it be like to dedicate or offer our practice to the sacred? Something about that is really quite powerful. Okay. A second thing we could bow to are the things we feel gratitude toward, you know, that we're happy about. We bow to beauty, we bow to joy, we bow or we clap perhaps, a winning quarterback throwing that touchdown pass that our team wins on the basis of. We're grateful. I'm not trivializing bowing in this sense. It's a mark of gratitude. We're thankful. Thank you. Maybe we bow our heads over our meal. You know, thank you. Maybe we give a nod of respect to someone who's prepared the feast. Thank you. Maybe we thank people, it's common for me, who have made a contribution. You know, thank you. Thank you, Albert Einstein, for figuring all that stuff out, right? Thank you. So you might ask yourself here too, what are you grateful for? What are you thankful for? And how would it feel in your heart to bow appreciatively toward it? Okay? And then the third bow, the hardest bow, is to bow toward what we don't like. And this is where I want to enter the topic through what you may know of as the so-called four divine messengers in Buddhism. And as you may know, the story goes that the Buddha was, as a young man, into his 20s, Siddhartha, was raised as a wealthy kid, relatively wealthy in that environment, in a feudal system 2,500 years ago. And in an extreme version of the story, he was kept inside a pleasure palace because his parents never wanted him to suffer illness or ugliness or disease or see anything that would alarm him. And then one day he snuck outside the castle walls, the palace walls. By the way, this story is extremely unlikely given the realities of life in an agrarian feudal environment, basically wealthy farmers, essentially. But he slipped outside, and there he encountered the four heavenly messengers. The first was someone who was sick. He encountered illness. The second messenger was he encountered an old person, weak, decrepit, falling apart, dementing, perhaps. And third, he encountered a corpse, the heavenly messenger of death. And he was appalled by this. He was shocked to realize that his life, inevitably, could encompass these things. And that everyone he loved was fated as well to face these things. And then he saw the fourth heavenly messenger, some monastic, walking along, rested in truth, radiantly at peace. The possibility of awakening, the possibility of freedom from this kind of suffering. In effect, Buddhism is one big bow to the four heavenly messengers. And it's interesting that they're described as divine messengers. It's a way to reframe it, that old age, disease, and death, which face basically all of us, we hope for old age, don't we? We hope for old age for our children and our friends. Everybody, one hopes. So we bow to these messengers because there's something divine about them, something heavenly, using these words fairly loosely, something sacred even about them. Because they teach us something deep and important about the realities of our life that, as animals, we tend to turn our gaze away from. So if you might want to think in your own life, like what it might be for you to bow to the pain in your body. It doesn't mean you like it or enjoy it or would wish it upon another person or wish it upon yourself if you had that choice, but it's there. It's like, can we bow to the inevitability of our beloved children, speaking personally, leaving home? How dare they live 3,000 miles away? What's wrong with them? Don't they know the plan? Anyway, we bow to people who don't buy our book. We bow to people who don't want to date us any longer, right? We bow to the inevitability, the reality of illness around the world. We bow to famine far away, not because we approve of it, but because basically, much as the Buddha is purported to have done on his own night of awakening, I see you. I see you, Mara, the embodiment of evil in the Buddhist frame, which is to say the evil of delusion or ignorance. We bow to it. We respect it. It exists. We accept it. We face it. We don't twist away from it. So you could ask yourself as well, what kind of things in this category, the hard things, the painful things, bow to loss, to losing a friend. My wife has a very close friend who has a very close friend and a whole family in which the man in the family, who's an elderly man who's gradually slipping into Alzheimer's, is going to arrange to take his own life. Wow. And how do we bow to that? How does the family face that and come to peace with that and come to terms with that? I have another friend who is a physician and in a very difficult, complex situation was involved with her family in eventually taking their mother off life support because they were crystal clear before their mother went into a coma and was unconscious that she would never have wanted to have been kept alive month after month, even year after year, in that sort of way. So how do people bow to that? So those are three kinds of things we can bow to. And then the question becomes, how do we bow? Do we bow grudgingly, resentfully? I'm reading a novel again I've read before, the Master and Commander Patrick O'Brien series, 20 phenomenal historical novels. And one of the main characters in a certain episode bows with perfect insolence. That's kind of the way it's described. You know, the contempt in his bow, to paraphrase it, perfectly matched the rudeness in this other lord, whatever, you know, count he was bowing toward. So we can bow with contempt, we can bow with dismissal, but can we bow with respect? Can we bow even with a certain surrender built into the bow? If you think about the physical gesture of bowing, particularly the way it's typically done, you know, like this, we gather ourselves in our center, bring together the multiple parts of ourselves, perhaps one way or another. I was in a religious practice for quite some time where people bowed by putting their hands over their heart like this, coming together and then bowing. So we come to some kind of center. And then there's this combination of presencing in awareness that which we are bowing to, and also presencing in awareness our own right attitude toward that which we're bowing toward. Doesn't mean we're bowing in some kind of obeisance or inappropriate subjugation of ourselves. We're not giving up our own view, our own autonomy. We bow autonomously to that to which we surrender. Also, speaking of the kind of theme I talked about last week, of refuge, we can bow as a kind of union with that to which we bow toward, or some aspect of that to which we bow toward. For example, the third kind of thing we bow toward, the hard things, you know, we in some way submit to or surrender to reality, one local expression of which is this hard thing. We can form union with reality. You may know the root of the word yoga is union. We may do the union, the yoga of bowing, even to things we don't approve of, to war, to corruption, to cruelty, to the cancer in our beloved cat. We bow to those things not because we like them, but because we respect and can surrender to reality altogether, which expresses itself in part with this hard thing. Many people, me included, have a hard time, especially people in the West, Americans. You know, less than no man, better than no man, in that traditional gender-based languaging, you know, as good as any. That's kind of a strong American ethic. And when I first actually was taught how to bow in this chaplaincy training I did once at Spirit Rock, it was hard to literally get down, even certain kinds of bowing, to get down on the knees and literally prostrate oneself significantly. Like, and it was interesting to watch what was so hard about that, what was culturally really hard. So you might find there's some resistance in the process for yourself. And again, I think it's important to tune in to what's comfortable, what feels right, you know. I think there's right bowing and wrong bowing, you know, wise bowing and foolish bowing. And you can find your own way to do it. So kind of finishing up and inviting you to talk about this and think about this with me here. We can bow to what we find sacred, bow out of reverence, can bow out of gratitude. And we can also bow out of acknowledgement. I acknowledge this pain. I bow to it. You know, I realize that you will never give me what I really want in this relationship. I can bow to that fact. I get it. This cancer is terminal. A few swear words arose in my mind there. And I can still bow to this fact. By the way, I don't have terminal cancer that I know about anyway. You see? So that's those kinds of bows. And I want to say that in terms of meditation, you could think about this for yourself. You might want to bring bowing into your own practice. And if it's not already there, perhaps bowing over a meal, inclining your head a little bit, or at your own practice, you might be interested in doing, or some version of what I do, which is when I'm by myself, bow three times. My first bow is to the divine. My second bow is to the Buddha. And my third bow, which arose intuitively, is kind of an interesting one. It's I'm bowing to the earlier versions of myself and all the other wholesome influences that have led me to this moment. And it's a kind of gratitude for them. And it's also a feeling of, okay, it's a reminding to myself, you've handed me this baton at this sitting, at this day, for this moment, I don't want to drop the baton. Thank you. I don't want to suck, right? So however you hold that, it's not like a self-critical burden, but there's something about that. And it just arose, and it was a very interesting thing to bow to the causes and conditions that led you to whatever is good and valuable and beneficial in this moment. And then when I'm done meditating, I repeat those bows. Okay. All right. Bowing. What a topic, huh? What do you think about it? Hands, great. Linda, we'll just kind of sweep the room this way. Great, Linda.
So I'm thinking that as with awareness, and we practice awareness of objects, and eventually we go just to awareness, not dependent on object. And you can have gratitude for objects, and it goes to gratitude.
Oh, yeah.
So bowing can be to objects, and then it goes to bowing.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Okay, great. Thank you. All right, Rod.
I've been bowing a lot since I got back from Thailand.
Yeah.
And the joy I've been having with it is, it's contagious.
Yeah.
Not with people who typically bow, with a clerk, with a person I gave a couple dollars to on the street corner, I bowed. And the person was stunned for a moment, but then bowed.
Yeah.
I mean, there are bows in everyone, whether they know it or not. Just waiting for some invitation. And I think that invitation is along the lines of what you're talking about. Really. Can we acknowledge each other in a way that is not offensive?
Yeah, thank you.
I want to add one thing. In Thailand, there's five different stages of bowing. You know, persons, family, teacher, holy family, their king, and then Buddha. Not only that, everyone that I meet at the grocery store, but even a little bow elicits a bow.
Yeah.
And the only part I would like to modify what you're saying, and I can't do it, because I can't think of any words to substitute for sacred and divine.
Yeah.
And I will come up with them one of these days.
Sure. Mystery. I mean, honestly, I've been reading about the latest research on the very instant of the Big Bang.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that right there, you don't know what else to bow to. Just bow that. Like, what? The universe just popped into existence, you know, instantaneously, and it's been expanding ever since. And here we are, inheriting all that 13.5+ billion years later. Thank you. Or I think about, you may see her TED Talk. What's her name? Annie Lamott. She has this phenomenal TED Talk, which became a book. Basically, I think it goes something like help, thank you, and wow. Those are her three words, you know, that are her three prayers, if you will. She's, yeah, okay, good. So we'll find a word. And if anyone will, the poet Rob will. Okay, let's see, Lily. Yeah.
A million things.
Sure.
But because I did a bunch of travel in Asia, including Thailand, and there's a lot of bowing and a lot of prostration. And I had a hard time with that because, you know, the Western version of Buddhism, the way I see it, is that, you know, it's not about, I guess it got mixed up with, like, idol worship, you know, which I see as a negative.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand that. And in Asia, there's like these, you know, 100-foot, 200-foot Buddhas, and everybody is bowing. And I didn't understand it, and it sort of offended me almost because it felt like idol worship. So I just didn't have any comment on that. I mean, the way you present bowing is lovely, but it's kind of a strange thing because that's my problem with it, is that I don't want to bow to a thing, or that seems wrong to me, and so that's where I get a little confused about bowing.
Yeah. Well, others may comment too, just briefly. One way to think of it is that object is a window through which whatever it is you're bowing to is shining. You know?
Even as a symbol? I mean,
yeah, it's a representative. Yeah, or a window. I'd worked in traditions where with murtis, sacred objects, a lot of bowing for them, and people understand that the piece of wood itself is not it. It's what it stands for, and in some sense it can become a kind of gatherer of a certain feeling or energy. I mean, who among us has not walked into some setting where you just feel like, whoa, something's going on here? And so that's a way you might think about it. I'll just leave it at that. It's kind of like bowing through the object, you know. And also, it could be, as Linda, I think, so beautifully said right there, just the bowing itself. This teacher I had for a while talked about the bodily sacrifice of attention. It's a kind of attention to that to which we bow to. You know, it's a kind of yielding to its existence, to what it is. And that right there is really powerful, people. One reason why, I asked my friend why he did 100,000 prostrations. He laughed. He's like a very senior psychologist. I know him, strong, willful, guy kind of guy, if you know what I mean. And like, what up? And he said, you know, there was something about it that just worked on me and helped me become more, not so much supple in my body, although 100,000 prostrations, that'll happen. But I became more supple in my mind. I'm not so positional. There's something more fluid about me as a result of all that in my deep psychology, in bowing all together as a way of relating to life. Anyway. Hi, others? Over, yeah, great.
So I think that the Western model is, as you said, was inappropriate, a feeling of inappropriate subjugation.
Yeah.
And I think that's weakening a little bit, at least in some parts of the country, maybe. But it made me think of, in Japanese baseball, when the hitter comes up to the plate, he gives a little bow to the umpire. I don't know if they do it all through the lineup, at least the first nine hitters, you know.
Oh, interesting.
Give a little bow. So it seems so much more easy in Asian, parts of Asian culture.
Yeah. I thought at first you were going to say the hitter bows to the pitcher, which would be very, but it does remind me of people in martial arts. There's like where people at the beginning of a game, they shake hands. Okay, you're here. We're going to do our thing, but there's a kind of respect there. Yeah. Think about what would it be like if you're in a conflict with a partner or somebody else that's significant to you, and you've got to talk about it, to bow to each other before talking about it, or if it gets heated, to pause and bow to each other. That could be real. I'm going to take that one home to my wife tonight. Okay. Yeah. Okay, first Tarne, then you. Yeah, Tarne.
In the Zen tradition, I practice some in the Zen tradition, and there's a lot of bowing in that, and very formal, ritualized bowing. And one of the bows we do is to our cushion before we sit on it.
Yeah.
Which opens up the whole, whatever happens on the cushion, I bow to it.
Yeah.
I'm open to it. It sets the tone for sitting.
That's great. Not because your cushion is an idol, but, right?
Far from it.
Great.
Well, my thought is that what I'm trying to learn is that there's a lot of strength in vulnerability.
Yeah.
What I'm working on.
That's beautiful. Thank you. You know, you can bow to qualities you're trying to cultivate, like bowing to vulnerability.
Yes.
Yeah. Great.
To me, the bowing feels like a very powerful support mechanism to evoke these feelings of submission and loving submission to a moment, and I think that's beautiful, but I think that I was curious to hear your thoughts on if it is a mechanism to support those sensations. At any point, do you feel that it is a burden or distraction from that to which it is supporting the loving submission? Do you think that there, I was wondering if you had any thoughts of negativity about the idea of bowing and what it may distract from, or if it is just a mechanism. I don't know, however you want to take that. That's just...
Yeah, no, it's cool. And there might be a glimmer in your eyes as well about it. I'll start with my experience. So to my surprise and kind of chagrin and then curiosity, I've noticed that when I bow at the beginning of meditation, it's actually quite common for me to go into this automatic bowing in which I'm writing an email, I'm just kind of spaced out, I'm thinking about the Friday Night Lights episode I saw the night before with my wife, you know, anything but God, like what? Or whatever it is I'm bowing to. So it's easy for bowing to become like anything else, an empty ritual. You know, if your mind's not there, your mouth's moving, you're chanting the words, you're bowing, whatever, but what's the point? You know, so there's that part. And you could say that a major aspect of Buddhism was the Buddha's critique of empty ritual. You know, the essence is, where's your heart? That's it. Is your heart in what you do? Or are you thinking about Friday Night Lights? Which is a great TV show, by the way. That said, you know. So that would be part one for me. You know, and then I think part two is, does the behavior take you away from what it is you're trying to cultivate, or does it serve you? You know, and I think sometimes people get quite into their practices, and their practices are actually getting in the way of, you know, what they want to really gain. So I would say both those things. Expanding this notion of bowing to really think about difficult people in your life, that's very interesting. And I find myself, I'm sometimes in situations where it's intractable. Maybe it's the estranged parent of a kid I'm working with. The estranged parent is creating, trust me, trouble of various kinds. But I can't do anything about that. So at a certain point, I just bow to my helplessness. Wow, bow to your helplessness to make a good thing, a bad thing better. Or bow to the fact that this other person just never going to agree or never even admit that a certain fact is a fact, let's say, that everybody else in the room can see as a fact. And you just kind of bow to it. And there's something really freeing in bowing. Think about that, like what it might be in a way to, even if you don't do the physical gesture, we can bow in our mind. Like I'll do things in my mind where it would be inappropriate to go into some kind of bow thing. Sometimes I'll do covert bowing. Did you see it? You missed it, right? It happened really fast. It's like a covert bow. If it works, it works, you know? But what I was going to say is sometimes just in my mind I'll just go, we're not going to see eye to eye, or you're not going to really change, are you? Three strikes, I get it. Best predictor of the future is the past. This dog is not going to hunt. There's no cheese down that tunnel, etc. And there's kind of an internal bow where we just got it. Maybe a couple more, and then we'll wrap up. Rob?
Just one quick one, because what you just said reinforced what I was thinking. The bow is like whatever's going on, at this instant, we are connected.
Yeah.
Whether it is an argument, whether it is a transaction in store, whether it's passing on the street, and passing on the street is fast, but you may bow.
Yeah.
Whatever it is that is our atmosphere right now, I am with you.
Yeah, thank you. So well said. And I just, maybe to wrap up here, what I was feeling there is kind of go with, if you could, go with me a little bit here. So imagine that you are, as Rob is saying, in truth with, in relationship with something or whatever you have reverence for, or deep respect for, or even find sacred. What's a natural response in that moment? It's to bow. Or think of something that you feel grateful for, your things you're very thankful for, very appreciative of. Thank you. You're in the truth of your relationship to that which you feel really thankful for. Again, what's a natural response? Right? One way or another, including a expressed only in your mind, is to bow. And then last, you know, there you are. You're in the truth of this thing that sucks. This really hard thing, tough thing, bad thing, painful thing. What's a natural response? It's to bow to it. Yeah, Linda. Thank you. Beautifully said. A good point to end on. How about we sit for a minute or so? Thank you all. I bow to the true goodness in all of us. See you.